Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and researcher Rachel McCarthy James. And we're talking about her book, Whack Job, A History of Axe Murder. Rachel, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark.
I expected one thing, and you gave me something much more interesting, which I love when authors do that. They don't do it often.
You always want to surprise the reader.
You don't do that often, but you really did a tremendous amount of research on the historical parts of this book. Talk to me about that process.
Thank you so much for saying that. Yeah, it was a really long process, but I really... and the history of axes, I was really interested to find that there wasn't something that took us from flint hand axes through when the axe got its handle and through steel making and everything. So that's kind of what I set out to write. And it was really a huge undertaking. It took me 6 years to write because there was so much background research, you know, especially in the earlier chapters where I'm talking about ancient Egypt, China, ancient Greece, Vikings, Henry VIII. I really had to do a lot of background research, talk to a bunch of experts to kind of get a grounding in what and knowing what I was talking about, being able to set the scene, the context, and set the scene culturally to kind of give you an idea, give the reader an idea of what axes meant in terms of power and state power and violence and oppression, because it changes from society to society, but there's a lot of different commonalities. Things that surprised me, like human sacrifice rituals. I didn't really think about the role that it might play, the role that the axe might play in human sacrifice rituals, but it was so fascinating to learn about, like, ancient China and learn about the really gruesome human sacrifice rituals that would take up sometimes thousands of people, and also see how it connected to, like, how we live today. The expert, Karen Wing, that I talked to about it was really... really made a point that it made a connection that there's human sacrifice rituals still today, usually not with axes, but usually things like triage, where you're trying to mediate these difficult things through rituals. But of course, the ones with axes, you know, 2,000 years ago were a lot bloodier and a lot more pointless, to our eyes at least.
And you bring up a point in the book, and it and you trace this evolution. It's the evolution of the axe, too, besides the story of a... You start out each chapter, each section, I should say, with a two or three page introduction to the axe of that time period. And then you trace it back to some murders that occurred with that specific kind of axe. In the beginning, blades were tough to come by. And it seems like by the time it gets to the middle of the 19th century, where we have things like the Bessemer process, and you talk about that in the book, that axes become more utilitarian and not as special as they did before.
Yeah, I would say that's true. Axes were definitely common, especially early on in history. And it's interesting to track that. One thing that I found really interesting was that, you know, we start out with flint hand axes, and that's where what axes were for a long time, for millions of years. And then once you add a handle, it becomes more powerful. But as that process is happening, we're also learning how to develop metal. But at the same time, people are still using stone hand axes for a long, long time into, I would say, about 1000 BC or so. They're still very common. And yes, the axe was starting to, I think in Europe especially, the axe was kind of starting to lose its relevance because Europe had been so deforested at this point, at the point when colonization of America started. And then once America began to be colonized, it became really relevant again because it was so thickly forested and there was so much land to clear, so many buildings that we needed to build, that it became a really crucial part of so many processes. And it was really a highly valued kind of a status symbol up until the Bessemer method that you mentioned, which was invented in about the 1850s and made steel much easier. Then there was an explosion of steel tools, not just axes, but hammers, you know, shovels, hoes, things like that.
When you write about the, and it was sort of an inevitable that you had to talk about Lizzie Borden, you could not avoid it. But one of the things I found fascinating is how many axes were in the house?
Yes, there were a ton of axes in the house, and they were a very urban family. You know, Falls River was not a farm. It was not in the country. It was right in town. But part of the conflict there, part of what's so interesting there, is that Andrew Borden was such a cheap, was a wealthy man, but he was also a cheap person, very close with a dollar, would not upgrade his house, get gas, get electricity, get running water in the upstairs. And so he was collecting these axes to kind of DIY home improvements instead of hiring it out. Doing stuff is like brutal and trivial as cutting off the heads of pigeons, as Lizzie thought once they used one of the axes. So they had two wood-cutting axes, I believe, and three hatchets in the basement. There might have been more. There's some confusion about that in the trial transcript.
We'll talk about that if we have time, yes. But people have to read that chapter.
That's true.
Getting back to the prehistoric.
Yes.
Was that the first murder that we have proof of?
Yeah, I believe it is. I don't think we have any earlier evidence of lethal interpersonal violence. So this is, it's about a cave in Spain, La Cima de los Huesos, the Pit of Bones, which researchers found. It's basically a burial pit because there's no other signs of humans living there. There's no fires. There's no hoofed animals there. It was a place where bodies were thrown in, and there's dozens of bodies in there, and several of them, including one specifically that I focus on called Cranium 17, have evidence of lethal interpersonal violence. Basically, there will be fractures in the skull, and this team of researchers studied these fractures and found that they were identical, which shows that someone had to have intentionally done it because the same branch can't fall on your head in the same exact way twice. And that could have been a few things. I mean, it could have been just a big undifferentiated rock, but one of the definite possibilities is a hand axe, which is a lot. And a hand axe at that point was a lot of different things. It was kind of a knife. It was kind of a hammer. It was the stem cell for a lot of different technologies that would develop. But we call it the hand axe because we use it for everything. And the axe is really used for everything. It's such a convenient item. It was really at hand for so much of human history. And that's what axe murder is really about in most cases. It's not so much about, the axe is a ritualistic object, like in my last book, The Man from the Train. It's more about the axe as something that it just happens to be there. It happens to be in the kitchen, happens to be in the wood, in the workplace, happens to be on hand in the battlefield. So it's really kind of an overlooked weapon, and that's what I found so interesting about it. It's something that's taken for granted so often, but it really comes into that makes it convenient, and it's when a conflict comes up all of a sudden, as most murderous conflicts do.
Now, all of these chapters are fascinating. We could do an entire interview
Thank
on any
so
one, but I'm gonna pick out two that I just had me. I want to talk about 1000 CE, Lance O. Meadows, the Iron Shipbuilding Axe.
Yes.
What a classic. Yes. What a classic. Now, we're talking about Vikings.
Yes.
And so you have the story of, is it Freydis Eriksdotter?
Freydis Eriksdotter, yes.
I don't want to go into all the details because I want to talk about other chapters too, but her violence was legendary. I mean, it was turned into the stuff of legends, but people think she may have really existed.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I think it's pretty clear that she existed. She's only like attested to in a couple of Norse poems, the Norse saga's big storytelling poems. There's two different stories about her. One in which she's the hero and uses a sword, and one in which she's a villain who tricks two brothers into going on an expedition to make money by chopping down trees in Canada with her, whom she ends up making her husband kill, and whose women they took with them, she ends up killing herself with an axe. So it's really a story of contrast. It's a story about greed, and it's a story about being your father's daughter and how violence is inherited and how she's kind of able to prove her status with this violence in a couple of different situations.
Well, that was the thing about Vikings, though. They had a lot of sort of family feuds.
Absolutely.
That they would carry through generations. There's a scene you quote in the book where she comes out of her tent naked and very pregnant and just goes at it.
Absolutely. Like, she scares them off by beating her breasts. they're having a conflict with the Native people there, and they're kind of surprised one night, and all of the men desert her, and she comes out and scares off the Native people by slapping her breast with a sword. And being bare-breasted is a really interesting, like, really rich art history phenomenon. You'll see it on, like, a lot of revolutionary art in France. The Virginia state flag is another example of it. So it's really a rich history. It's so interesting how many different things end up intersecting with the axe and the story of the axe and the story of weapons. And I think it's a really interesting, one of the things that I track is, you know, Vikings and axes are so associated, but Vikings didn't particularly care about axes. It's just that they needed them for everything because they were such a seafaring culture, and axes are so important to, or were at this point, so important to keeping the ship afloat, basically. But they really preferred swords. Swords were much more honorable. Swords were much more prestigious, whereas the axe was, like I was saying earlier, just kind of taken for granted. It was just around everywhere, so it often came up in Viking violence.
Well, let's talk about the axe first before we move on. It was the blade was made of iron?
Yes, they did have iron axes, yes.
And it was sort of a shortish handle. It wasn't long handle.
Yeah, no, there are shorter handles, more to be used with one hand, but there are some longer ones. But yeah, Viking axe heads do tend to be a little bit smaller than many of them, but they also had Danish axes, which are very huge and which were employed by, for example, King Henry VIII.
That's who I want to talk about next.
Really huge, and that was a very long. I mean, to cut someone's head off cleanly, you need a lot of leverage. So that had a very long handle.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and researcher Rachel McCarthy James, and we're talking about her book. It's really a fascinating read. Whack Job: A History of Axe Murder. Now I have to say, the Henry VIII chapter was wild.
Yes.
And I want to go into that in detail. So we're talking about the early 1500s, 1510 in London. And we're going to be talking about the executioner's axe. What was it like?
So usually they would use a pretty large Dane axe, which has a really big head, really long handle, lots of leverage. But what was really interesting to me about that chapter was the different ways the executioner played a role.
Oh, yeah.
Because the executioner could be very experienced, could be very comfortable with the axe, and thus could provide basically a good death, a clean death experience where you're not hacking the neck. It's one slice and you're done. But several others got a very unpleasant experience where they were hacked away at. Margaret Plantagenet.
I want to build this up a bit. I want to talk about Henry VIII, first of all. He basically ruled through personal revenge and execution, and it got worse as he got older.
It did. It absolutely did. Execution was a huge part of the culture, and it was kind of an expected part of the culture. People wanted to see executions. It was part of public entertainment in a lot of ways. So there was a big precedent for him to start using the axe immediately. And one of the first people I focused on were two of his father's taxmen, Richard Edmund and Dudley Empsey, I believe. I'm sorry, I'm messing that up. Who collected taxes for his father and were very reviled public figures already. So that was kind of a way for him to make it seem break with his father's reign and say, this is a new era. This is going to be more fair. We're not going to overtax you, but we might kill you. He used the axe a ton. He killed, I think, 50,000 or 60,000 people. And Richard Empson and Edmund Dudley were those men, middle-class men, who had done a lot of Henry VII. But then it's kind of escalated over time and stopped being about trying to demonstrate his policy procedures, basically, and became a lot more about his paranoia and who he thought might be a threat to him. For example, his cousin, the Duke of Buckingham, who was very wealthy, very popular, and was eventually just got caught talking, gossiping about Henry VIII, and Henry VIII had been looking for an excuse to kind of get rid of him. Their story repeats several different times. You know, it was all about avoiding displeasing Henry VIII, but this man was so paranoid and so going mad that it was impossible not to displease him at some point. And for that, you would often get the axe. But the axe was kind of a dignified, stately way to die.
As opposed to being drawn and quartered.
Exactly, as opposed to being drawn and quartered or burned at the stake or something like that. You know, the axe has been used for centuries already, for millennia already at this time, as a method of execution. So it's got, it's a classic way to die. It's got a lot of dignity. It's fairly quick. You're able to, say your last words with some measure of composure, which is really important. But even then, Anne Boleyn was executed, but she requested something more stylish than the axe. It was the last nice thing he ever did for her, was getting a French swordsman rather than a common English axe.
Now,
it was
where
kind of her last display of style.
Where were people executed?
So usually there was a place called Tower Hill near the Tower of London, and that's where most people were executed. And that was a big site. Thousands and thousands of people were executed over the years. There was also a hanging tree right near there where less dignified executions would take place. But women were usually executed within the Tower Green, which was much less public, less of a crowd. There was still some people would gather to witness it, but it was much more rarefied in there. And that's where most women that he killed, especially upper-class women, queens and whatnot, would die.
Now, you describe Catherine Howard as she belongs in a teen drama.
Yes. It's so sad. She was, at 21 at most when she died. Once Henry VIII got his eyes on her, there wasn't really any way to avoid it. She's just a young, beautiful woman who was very focused on behaving politely and presenting a pretty picture, and just, had no time to mature or think about how to escape his clutches like some of his older wives did. Really sad story. One of the most tragic, in a way, in the whole book.
Well, the thing I found really tragic about her is I think she was the one that asked for the execution block,
yes,
to be brought into her cell so she could,
yes,
practice the best way to lay her head on the block.
Yes. Once she was able to accept her death, that was a big part of it. I mean, rituals are so important to people. They're as important to the condemned as they are to the larger society and the people who are doing the execution. It's a big part of how to accept your fate and go bravely to your death. The afterlife was really real for the people of Tudor England. It was not something that was questioned. It was something that was certain. So they had, they were looking forward to being on the other side of it and having an afterlife that was free of Henry VIII and his whim.
Oh, God. Well, and the last, one of the last women that he executed, Margaret. It was a botched executioner's job.
It sounded like
it's a person that was new to the job. The axe wasn't sharp.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded horrible.
Not only that, but she didn't have any time to prepare herself whatsoever. She did not know until maybe an hour before she was to be executed. She had been held in the Tower of London for years at that point. And that wasn't great. She knew she was under the threat of execution. She knew that horrible things could happen to her. But he basically put her in there and forgot about her. So she assumed that she would just kind of live out the rest of her days there. And she was a woman of great dignity. She was a woman of a lot of prestige. And the fact that she didn't get a chance to say her prayers, that she didn't get a chance to meet and confess her sins, she was Catholic, and that would have been an added problem, of course, there, but she didn't get a chance to meet with any religious officials or anything, get her soul nice and clean for God. She didn't get a chance to say her last words. She was taken fighting to the block, which is not how everyone else in this chapter died. Most people were able to compose themselves and find some peace with it, but not Margaret. Not Margaret.
Now, you had to deal with Lizzie Borden. It was just one of the more prominent sort of close in history. But the fascinating thing is when you look at all the evidence, first of all, they weren't careful about evidence at all at that period of time.
No, it's interesting because, I'm going through these ancient chapters where I'm looking at a line in Herodotus, looking at this one story that's been reconstructed from royal graves and things like that. And then you hit Henry VIII, and suddenly there's so much information about everything. You know what they ate for breakfast. You know what they said to each other, what they whispered to each other as they were on the way to the execution. So it was interesting to see that kind of influx of information. And Lizzie Borden is an interesting point, too, because 1892, people understood that you should collect evidence, but they didn't really have any idea as to how to do that. You know, in this era of crime, they would just troop through the living room and look at the scene themselves. You know, there would be fingerprints everywhere, footprints everywhere. And it's really interesting because there's things like this, new enough to want to take pictures to preserve, to show in court, but they actually moved Abby Borden's body to take the pictures, which just destroys the entire purpose. And there's a lot of things like that there. And that kind of led to, there's a lot of understanding of like how Andrew's body was clearly freshly dead when they discovered it, but it was clear that Abby's body had been dead for a couple of hours. So there are useful insights like that, and there's something like go ahead.
There's I'm going to move on from this, but we only have a few minutes left. But there was so much stuff going on between the two murders. I mean, there were several people in the house.
Yes, people in the house.
Lizzie. Yeah. Who was having her period, or as you, as you quote,
flea bites, as they call it.
Is that the flea bites?
That was the name for it around there.
She basically was in Victorian dress that only had like a tiny spot of probably her own blood. I mean, it, as you sum it up, it's just a maddening puzzle.
It is.
And that's it. And you can't draw any kind of conclusion.
No, it's really hard to draw a conclusion. I mean, you look at it from one sense, and common sense says, you know, this woman did have some kind of motive. She's the only one who's not killed in this house besides Bridget Sullivan, her maid. But then you look at it and you think the whole problem with it is that the prosecution really fixated on this one axe that they found, one hatchet that they found in the basement that did not have a handle. They thought that she used the hatchet to kill her father and stepmother and then went and took the handle off with a vise, and then also did a complete costume change. And I feel like people want to impose a narrative on this story, and the more you try to impose a narrative on it, the more it breaks down. You know, the axe, the idea of her taking this handle off doesn't make sense in the first place, but then also the handle was, they said that she set the handle on fire to hide the blood stain. But the handle was still where they found it. They just hadn't bothered to look for it that hard. So it's a really interesting view into how police procedure has always been a little bit sketchy, and there's always going to be some surprises in the trial.
One of the last cases you talk about, not the absolute last one, 1980 in Wiley, Texas, the Betty Gorin candy story. And you bring in an interesting thing. It first of all, the whole trial and the whole story and Candy's whole story is insane.
It's bizarre.
Bizarre. She didn't like to be shushed.
Yes, pretty much. And but, it's something that she could have only gotten away with during that period when insanity defenses gave people a lot of cover.
But one of the important things you bring up is how things like axe murders are now treated by the media. And I was surprised to learn there were four films made up of that.
Yes, I think three have been made of it. Yeah, there was a television movie in 1990, and then there were like two. It was funny. I wrote that for my proposal, and then the month after I signed the contract, there were two different series announced. I was like, okay, I guess I'm on to something. I mean, axe murder in 1980 and today is not a very common thing. It really wasn't even common when the phrase first came into newspaper language in the 1910s. You know, guns took over a long time ago.
But it's interesting that, and you even talk about the films that have been made about axe murdering in general. Straightjacket, one of the great ones.
That's a good one, The Shining, of course, is a big one.
The Shining, but also So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Yes, yeah, that's really why it's become kind of a comic phrase in recent years. You know, that wasn't it was a box office failure, but it's become a cult success. And the catchiness of that title, So I Married an Axe Murderer, has really brought the phrase a comic tinge that I don't think it's ever going to lose, really.
Now, when you wrote The Man from Texas, The Man from the Train, excuse me.
Yes.
That was about an axe murderer, wasn't it?
Yes.
So what is, why is the public so fascinated by axe murdering now?
I think there's something, you know, the axe is, it's still relevant. It's still used.
Does it just seem like an anachronistic weapon to use to kill someone?
Exactly. It's anachronistic. And it's so, I think part of it is that, you know, large-scale violence gets more and more remote. It's easier and easier to kill people with the press of a trigger or with drone violence. And the axe is necessarily very up close and personal. It's very brutal. It's very bloody. It's very visceral. So I think that's a major part. And also, you know, we still have other weapons that you can use to do that kind of up close and personal violence, like knives. You know, knives are still around. But axes, not everyone has an axe. Certainly not everyone has an axe handy, like they did in the 19th century with like Crime and Punishment. So it's becoming more and more of a curiosity. And I think but it's at the same time, though, you know, with homelessness on the rise everywhere, more and more unhoused people are using axes for its daily intended purpose, you know, making fires, making shelter, clearing land. And so in a lot of homelessness comes with a lot of conflicts, too, a lot of very mortal conflicts. So it's more likely to be held at hand in those kind of conflicts. I think there's seeing a lot more of those across the country.
We're completely run out of time. We could talk about this book forever. My guest tonight is writer and researcher Rachel McCarthy James. And we're talking about her book, Whack Job, A History of Axe Murder. Rachel, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.